Okay, welcome everybody. Good evening, good morning, wherever you are. Welcome to another Thursday seminar at the Center for the History of Global Development. My name is Iris Vorwey. I am one of the directors of the center, along with my colleague, Tony McGrew, who's also here. And I am very happy. I'm delighted, in fact, to have Professor George Bob Milliar here, who will talk to us today about an area or region that we don't hear about or we don't discuss in the seminar as often as we should, because the African continent is certainly the coming area of the, certainly of the second part of the 21st century. You don't have to be very prophetic to say that. Okay, Professor Bob Milliar is Senior Lecturer at the Department of History and Political Studies and also Director of the Center of Cultural and African Studies at the Kwame Nkrumah University of Science and Technology in Kumasi in Ghana. He was also a three-term former head of the department at that university. He holds a PhD in African Studies from the University of Ghana, and his research focuses on an admirably broad spectrum of topics ranging from the democratization in Africa, electoral politics in Ghana, informal economies, African diaspora, the political economy of development, and actually a few topics more. But this gives you an idea of the range of interests that he has. He was visiting fellow or guest lecturer also at a large number of international institutions, including the University of Cambridge, the Makerere University in Uganda, the Danish Institute of International Studies, the University of Copenhagen, and also, and I'm happy about that, at the Johannes Gutenberg University of Mainz in Germany. He received the African Author Prize for best article published in African Affairs, the journal African Affairs, by an author based in Africa, and also the prize for his research at the Center for International Governments and Governments Innovation. He is currently the editor of the journal African Political Economy and Development, and also a member of the editorial board of the journals African Affairs and African Reviews of Economics and Finance. He has published very widely. So again, I can only mention a few examples. In 2012, he published an article called Party Factions and Power Blocks in Ghana, which came out in the Journal of Modern African Studies. And last year, he had two articles that I would like to mention. One is called Economic Potential of Northern Ghana, which came out in the African Economic History, in the Journal of African Economic History. And I think this is probably very important, and if we had more time in the Q&A, maybe we could quiz him about that. Introduction into Research Methodology in Africa, which came out in African Affairs. And if I understand correctly, his lecture tonight actually forms part of an ongoing project in which he is engaged. And with that, I would like to hand the floor to you and invite you to look forward to your lecture.
Right. Thank you so much for the invitation, and I'm very happy that I have this opportunity. Just like you mentioned, yes, sometimes we in Africa we also want to have audiences beyond the continent to hear about the research that we're conducting. So what I'm going to present to you is part of a larger project that I'm working on. I'm almost in the third year now. Since Ghana made the return to multi-party politics, we've observed some developments within the country. Economic developments, forms of developments that previously were not so widespread. So I started this project trying to look at Ghanaian conceptualization of capitalist mode of accumulation. Contrary to what the literature says, it appears, at least where I studied, which is the Asante region, that the Asantes have always accumulated before colonialism, before it's accumulated, and they believe in wealth accumulation, and they have these modes of productions that were not very well highlighted in the existing literature. So this project expanded beyond Asante to the whole of Ghana. And I'm trying to reflect on this, going beyond Ghana, to look at the return to multi-party politics and how that has brought about developments, market practices in Ghana. So that is basically what this presentation is all about. So I'll try and deliver that in the minutes that I have. Now, we look at promotion of capitalist forms of development through what in the early 1990s, Van der Waal and Michael Bratton calls a democratic experiment. Virtually, Africa was reintroducing democracy after almost 2 to 3 decades of, in some countries, 2 decades, in other countries, 15 years of one-party state military dictatorship. So in the early 1990s, many countries in sub-Saharan Africa made a return to multi-party politics. And by the 2000s, what I'm calling a party or electoral democracy was taking roots in Africa. And according to Stefan Lindbergh, that Africa actually democratized through the holding of elections, that elections were held repeatedly. And there's this other larger project that we can situate African democracies within, which is what they call the Varieties of Democracies Project. And that within sub-Saharan Africa, countries are very diverse. And that because of this diversity, democracies across the continent are unique. What we have in Nigeria is not the same as we have in Ghana. Even Ghana is next door, La Côte d'Ivoire, which is a French speaking. The democracy that is emerging there is different. But overall, what we have across the continent is liberal democracy with its liberal logics of emphasis on the market, liberalization. And that within this liberal environment, we have an emergence of a middle class of Africans. And that, of course, democracy, according to its promoters, claim that liberal democracy is contributing to the emergence of a new middle class. But overall, it appears there's demand for democracy. Africans want more democracy. According to Afrobarometer survey, that Ghanaians prefer democracy to all other forms of government. This is very high, close to nearly 80% of Ghanaians prefer liberal democracy, and that elites demand liberal democracy more. And of course, those who have university education prefer liberal democracy to other forms of government. Within this survey, you also see that there's the gender gap, which is a bit puzzling in the sense that men demand more democracy than women. But of course, if you are familiar with African history of dictatorship, anytime there was a military coup, there was a centralization of power, it's the women that suffered the most. So this finding is quite puzzling. And that, of course, but democracy across the continent has come with a number of conditionalities, that there is that close connection between liberal democracy and economic growth in sub-Saharan Africa. And that we find out that within sub-Saharan Africa, some 17 countries, including Rwanda, Ghana, appear to be on the move, and that averagely, economic growth has hovered between 3 to 5% of GDP. Growth is largely driven by commodities. And of course, it's because of the Chinese appetite for commodities, copper, cocoa, gold, oil. And this has helped push commodity prices. And of course, those who have oil in large abundance are those that have benefited. Nigeria, Angola, Gabon are all, but it's because of that. But this growth has not actually reflected in figures when you look at it, and it has not trickled down to the masses. So distribution of income has become more unequal, even including Ghana that I studied. You see that there's a lot of inequality across the country. Nevertheless, many states have witnessed some level of economic transformation. There is massive investment in infrastructure, new roads, shopping malls, housing. This is to suggest that, yes, liberal democracy with its logic of liberalization, market fundamentalism, appears to have yielded some dividends, what in the literature they call democratic dividends, if you look at the countries. And one of the tangible one is peace, of course, that many countries that have returned to multi-party politics, they have some level of peace. And that within this, you have an emergence of a new capitalist class. I put new in quotes because it's not new, it's just that the environment has changed. And that is why we see these guys who are running private businesses become very visible. So the question is the economic transformation across the continent driven by indigenous capitalists? Is this transformation driven by African-based capitalists, or is multinationals who are driving this transformation? And is Africa returning to its capitalist roots? And can we talk of African capitalism? I feel that yes, we can talk of that. But that the business environment for accumulation of private capital is still very difficult. The institutions that drive it, capital accumulation in many African countries don't exist. And that patronage politics and so-called neo-patrimonial infrastructure is a hindrance to the accumulation and for capitalist transformation to take roots, deep roots. Now, we situate this in the Ghanaian context within the broader debates. Economic, it talks about economic governance plus political governance would automatically lead to improved development. That's a claim. And that you find that human development will improve. Okay. And if you take cases randomly from across Africa, that in countries where you see that economic governance has improved, together with political governance, that you see some improvement. We are interested in the history of it. And this is where I emphasize that if you look at indigenous forms of capitalist production or accumulation, that the history tells us, at least in the Ghanaian case, or if you read more broadly, economic history of West Africa, that African pre-colonial societies demonstrated there's evidence of modes of accumulation, capitalist development. And you read Paul Hill, looks at the cocoa industry in the Gold Coast. Dennis Austin looks at all of these. But politically, which is the area that we are focusing on, that these transitions that happened in the early 1990s, that these were politics without rules in many countries, because it was military dictatorships or single party civilian dictators who initiated the return to multi-party politics. So yes, access to state power could be equated to wealth accumulation and privileges. And according to Lindsay Whitford, her study of Ghana shows that the Ghanaian context, she talks about what she calls competitive clientelism, that it's a competition between the ruling elites to accumulate. And that you find out that economic transformation is happening without an industrial policy. And Kobina Opoku also argues that in the Ghanaian context, there's a relationship between government and business. And I'm going to emphasize that going forward. You see that in the context that I'm just talking about now, in the party democracy that has been established, there's that relationship between ruling government policy and how capitalist accumulation happens, how production comes about. How do I contribute to this debate? Now, this talk builds on this literature by extending it in three ways. First, situating capitalist form of development within party democracy, and that politically oriented capitalists flourish in Ghana's Fourth Republic. Second, it builds on a long-term perspective, which allows me to explore the complex relation between state and government and the indigenous capitalist class. And finally, the steady work that I'm doing now builds from the micro level analysis, comparison between Ghana's different geographical zones, and it allows for understanding of the various types of market practices at play. Now, briefly, I go to the emergence of indigenous accumulators. That in the Ghanaian context, three areas are very important for historicizing the emergence of indigenous capitalism. The first phase is the pre-colonial colonial, that is from the 1800s to the 1950s. Then the second phase is the post-independent era, 1960s to the early 1980s or mid 1980s. Then the contemporary era, the neoliberal era, from the late 80s to the present. That in the Ghanaian context, that is the pre-colonial colonial, I take one case, the Asante state, which one of the last of the Akan states to emerge in what was then called the Gold Coast, a very centralized state that was built through trade and war. It was built on prosperous trade in gold, ivory, slaves, rubber, palm oil, timber, cocoa. And that accumulation patterns between the 18th and the 19th century was organized around participation in the state. And within the Asante state, you needed permission from the kingdom of the Asante to participate in trade. And according to McCaskey, he says, and I quote him, membership in the state became the only certain avenue to the possibility of acquiring great wealth, end of quote. Yes, so you needed to be a member and to be given permission to participate in trade. And economically successful individuals were given the title of Obrenpong, which is big man, the direct translation. And you find this term being abused. I'll call it abuse because in the Africanist political science literature, they refer to big man with negative connotations when they talk about big man. But in the pre-colonial era, big man was a very successful trader who accumulated so much wealth. The cocoa business also contributed to the emergence and the development of a capitalist class. Okay, cocoa farming, which spread from the eastern part of Ghana to the forest zone, was participated in by almost all the communities that laid or found themselves within the forest belt of Ghana. Yes, and that by the end of the colonial period, half of the adult male population of Asante was profitably engaged in cocoa production. That's according to indigenous capital accumulation, right? And that this accumulation had challenges and what I'm calling the death of indigenous capitalism. That indigenous capitalists founded the first independent movement. Okay, that after the Second World War, the Gold Coast intelligentsia founded a movement, okay, known as the United Gold Coast Convention in August 1947. And this movement demanded for political independence. Now, Nkrumah was a member of this movement as its general secretary. But Nkrumah, having schooled in the United States of America, you know, has always been very suspicious of business people. So Nkrumah left the UGCC and founded his own political party, the Convention People's Party. And it was this party that led Ghana to independence. And from the word go, this party has always been anti-capitalist. Nkrumah favored state-led development. The cocoa sector was controlled by the State Marketing Board. And this was the first confrontation between Nkrumah and the indigenous capitalist class when the State Marketing Board fixed the prices for cocoa beans. And this became a major issue. So the opportunities to accumulate assets became less under Kwame Nkrumah. And eventually, Nkrumah's reach. Regime was overthrown in the military. Present to you in this table is soldiers, politicians, and revolutionaries. So from 1966 until 1992, there've been alternation of governments, military, civilian. So Ghana have had three civilian republics before the introduction of the 1992 constitution. And that the 1992 constitution introduced the fourth republic, which is the focus. And that, yes, the birth of the Fourth Republic. The last military coup happened on the 31st December 1981, led by Flight Lieutenant Jerry John Rawlings. And when Rawlings overthrew the civilian regime, there were demands constantly for Rawlings to hand over. And the response has always been, hand over to whom? Okay, and that this was, for a very long time, Rawlings' policy. And the 1980s, generally in the development literature, referred to as the lost decades. That this was the period that many African countries, including Ghana, did not experience any development. Almost all the indicators registered negative. Okay, of course, once these countries' survival were threatened, a lot of them searched for internal external support. And in the Ghanaian case, that external support was sought from the World Bank and the IMF. That was when the country made the shift to market logics and market practices. The IMF came with conditionalities, liberalization, and with the further demands from the domestic front for country to democratize. So eventually, Rawlings had to set in a framework to return the country to multi-party politics. And Ghana eventually introduced and inaugurated the Fourth Republic on the 7th of January, 1993. And that Fourth Republic has been the longest surviving till date. And as I speak, it's still the same republic that we are in. It is a republic that has been characterized by party politics. The emphasis has been on elections. And Ghana is seen as a model in the sub-region, largely because of the very successful nature that it has conducted its multi-party elections. Since 1992, we've had 8 successful multi-party elections, but it is a political system that is described as multi-party system in the 1992 constitution, but eventually it has become a de facto two-party system and is dominated by the National Democratic Congress and the New Patriotic Party. So these two parties are those that have held power and they have alternated power. The political system is also very competitive and is characterized by a logic of the winner takes it all, because it's first past the post. So once the party wins the majority of seats in power, the party accumulates enough political power and dominates the political system. And that Ghana's political system has achieved a measure of democratic consolidation, seen through the peaceful change of government in, from incumbent to opposition. So in 2001, we had the first alternation of power from incumbent to opposition. Then 2009, another incumbent to opposition. Then 2017, another incumbent opposition. This is unique in the Ghanaian context. And if you look at African context, Ghana can be counted among only very few, 4 countries or 3 that have experienced the change of government through peaceful means. And that it has come as a result of elite consensus by the political elites in the country. It appears there's a consensus between the political elites and that power can be changed through peaceful means, and that democracy is the only game in town, to quote from some scholars' sources. And that this is made possibly through constitutionalism. In the Ghanaian context, presidential term limits are fixed, they are entrenched. Each president can have 2 terms and you are out. It's not easy for the president to extend their term. You need to go to a referendum and you need to have a turnover of 80% plus, and that no president has attempted doing that. And there's a rule of law and respect for the due process and the institutionalization of programmatic politics. Of course, constitutionalism also means that the environment is very pro-business, and this is where capitalist modes of accumulation and production, and that investment is secured in this kind of environment, which is more neoliberal kind of thinking. Now, I go to party ideology and how party ideology contributes to capitalist forms of development. As I said in the previous slide, that Ghana has 2 dominant parties, even though the constitution prescribes a multi-party system, and there are several political parties in Ghana. But in terms of relevance, it's only the National Democratic Congress and the New Patriotic Party that have governed. the National Democratic Congress is a party that puts itself center left. It's a party of the masses. It grew out of the Provisional National Defense Council, which was a military regime led by Rawlings. Now, Rawlings has never professed any ideology, of course, but almost all his antics, rhetoric, and platform pointed towards populism and socialism. But the NDC began to style itself as a social democratic party. It's interested in progressive politics, and is interested in protection for the underprivileged and the upliftment of the socially disadvantaged in the Ghanaian society. That's what it says as it operationalizes its ideology. The NPP, that is currently the governing party, the New Patriotic Party, puts itself to the right of center. It is a party that claims a political tradition that is over 70 years old. It traces its origins to the United Gold Coast Convention, and it defines its policy as the party that is interested in liberating the energies of people for the growth, and I quote here, for a property-owning democracy. Property-owning democracy. So clearly, for the MPP, the party's ideology is in favor of market logic. It's in favor of liberating the energies of Ghanaians to produce, to accumulate, and they've always done that. So how do political parties in the Ghanaian environment promote capitalist development? First, the policies of governing parties plays a major role in how capitalist forms of development is initiated in this environment. The government, whether NDC or the MPP, they are almost all of them, they've come to the realization that public-private partnerships arrangements are the way to go, and they've always sought and tried to implement them. Secondly, they've come to the realization or the belief, which is an argument that is still, there's no consensus that the state has no role in development, and that the statist policies that were promoted by Kwame Nkrumah and other military regimes contributed to the underdevelopment of the Ghanaian economy. So, in the Fourth Republic, the political class have embraced this market logic of privatization. There's emphasis on privatization of state assets. And this is one way that governing parties are promoting development, which is supported by the IMF and the World Bank. Then there's the government loan schemes that is promoted heavily. These are taxpayers' money that are used to promote development. Then another form of capitalist development is the use of procurement services. And finally, government contracts. Government contracts. The state is the larger buyer of almost everything. It's the greatest accumulator when it comes to and distributor of a revenue. So the same way that governing parties would use contracts, the provision of infrastructure to try to engineer development, capitalist form of development. All right, very important. Finally, I look at a case study. There are several case studies, but just one for an illustration. This is a wholly Ghanaian-owned company. It's called Zoom Lion. It's a limited liability company that was established in 2006. It's a waste management company that's also interested in environment. So Zoom Lion was set up by a Ghanaian, and Zoom Lion has signed contract with district assembly, these are local authorities to manage waste. And Zoom Lion employs close to 1 million Ghanaians. It also operates across other African countries in the West African sub-region. It's in the southern part of Africa, Angola, Zambia, Equatorial Guinea, Sierra Leone, and South Sudan. Now, this is a company that was supported by government. So it's operated within this neoliberal environment. And it's a classic case of how party democracy has contributed to capitalist forms of development. There are several other examples. I will now try and wrap up that. In my concluding remarks, I say that Ghana has recorded some level of economic transformation, with the reintroduction of civilian politics. That's a fact. And that the logics of the market has created the environment for indigenous businesses to grow, several of them. And that the policies of governing parties has promoted capitalist form of development. And in the Fourth Republic, we see small boys, in quotes, who are politically oriented capitalists flourish within governing parties. So thank you so much for your attention. I'll now stop sharing my slides. Yes, thanks.